On the morning after he bailed Rosa Parks out of jail, E.D. Nixon placed a call to the new minister of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, Martin Luther King Jr. It was a little after 5 a.m., but Nixon didn't say hello or ask if he had awoken King's two-week-old daughter when the minister answered. He just launched into an account of Parks' arrest, how she had been hauled into jail for refusing to give up her seat, and their plans to fight her case in court and boycott the city's buses on Monday. At the time, King was 26 years old. He had been in Montgomery for only a year and was still trying to figure out his role within the community. Nixon was asking for King's endorsement as well as permission to use his church for a boycott meeting that night. King was wary of getting too deeply involved. "Brother Nixon," he said, "let me think about it, and you call me back." But Nixon didn't stop there. He reached out to one of King's closest friends, one of the strongest of King's strong ties, named Ralph D. Abernathy, and asked him to help convince the young minister to participate. A few hours later, Nixon called King again. "I'll go along with it," King told him. "I'm glad to hear you say so," Nixon said, "because I've talked to 18 other people and told them to meet in your church tonight. It would have been kind of bad to be getting together there without you." Soon, King was drafted into serving as president of the organization that had sprung up to coordinate the boycott. On Sunday, 3 days after Parks' arrest, the city's black ministers, after speaking to King and other members of the new organization, explained to their congregations that every black church in the city had agreed to a one-day protest. The message was clear. It would be embarrassing for any parishioner to sit on the sidelines. That same day, the town's newspaper, The Advertiser, contained an article about a top-secret meeting of Montgomery Negroes who plan a boycott of city buses Monday. The reporter had gotten copies of flyers that white women had taken from their maids. The black parts of the city were flooded with thousands of copies of the leaflets, the article explained, and it was anticipated that every black citizen would participate. When the article was written, only Parks' friends, the ministers, and the boycott organizers had publicly committed to the protest. But once the city's black residents read the newspaper, they assumed, like white readers, that everyone else was already on board. Many people sitting in the pews and reading the newspapers knew Rosa Parks personally and were willing to boycott because of their friendships with her. Others didn't know Parks, but they could sense the community was rallying behind her cause, and that if they were seen riding a bus on Monday, it would look bad. "If you work," read a flyer handed out in churches, "take a cab or share a ride or walk." Then everyone heard that the boycott's leaders had convinced, or strong-armed, all the black taxi drivers into agreeing to carry black passengers on Monday for 10 cents a ride, the same as a bus fare. The community's weak ties were drawing everyone together. At that point, you were either with the boycott or against it. On the Monday morning of the boycott, King woke before dawn and got his coffee. His wife, Coretta, sat at the front window and waited for the first bus to pass. She shouted when she saw the headlights of the South Jackson line, normally filled with maids on their way to work, roll by with no passengers. The next bus was empty as well, and the one that came after. King got into his car and started driving around, checking other routes. In an hour, he counted 8 black passengers. 1 week earlier, he would have seen hundreds. "I was jubilant," he later wrote. A miracle had taken place. Men were seen riding mules to work, and more than one horse-drawn buggy drove the streets of Montgomery. Spectators had gathered at the bus stops to watch what was happening. At first, they stood quietly, but as the day progressed, they began to cheer the empty buses and laugh and make jokes. Noisy youngsters could be heard singing out, "No riders today!" That afternoon, in a courtroom on Church Street, Rosa Parks was found guilty of violating the state's segregation laws. More than 500 blacks crowded the hallways and stood in front of the building, awaiting the verdict. The boycott and impromptu rally at the courthouse were the most significant black political activism in Montgomery's history, and it had all come together in 5 days. It had started among Parks' close friends, but it drew its power, King and other participants later said, because of a sense of obligation among the community, the social habits of weak ties. The community was pressured to stand together for fear that anyone who didn't participate wasn't someone you wanted to be friends with in the first place. There are plenty of people who would have participated in the boycott without such encouragement. King and the cabbies and the congregations might have made the same choices without the influence of strong and weak ties. But tens of thousands of people from across the city would not have decided to stay off the buses without the encouragement of social habits. The once dormant and quiescent Negro community was now fully awake, King later wrote. Those social habits, however, weren't strong enough on their own to extend a one-day boycott into a year-long movement. Within a few weeks, King would be openly worried that people's resolve was weakening, that the ability of the Negro community to continue the struggle was in doubt. Then those worries would evaporate. King, like thousands of other movement leaders, would shift the struggle's guidance from his hands onto the shoulders of his followers, in large part by handing them new habits. He would activate the third part of the movement formula, and the boycott would become a self-perpetuating force.